Are you a clinician in primary care who wishes there were better resources to help you understand how to navigate the concept of triage in modern general practice? We'll boost your triage skills with our dynamic 5-session live webinar course tailored for primary care clinicians. Led by myself and Dr. Ed Pooley from Difficult Conversations, this comprehensive training covers all facets of remote patient triage, whether that be digital, on-call, or other opportunities. Through this course, you'll gain practical knowledge, exclusive hints and tips, and direct access to myself and Ed through open Q&A sessions of the course. Elevate your ability to manage primary care challenges effectively and confidently, and most importantly, safely. Register now to transform your triage approach at bit.ly/GP triage course, the GP in capitals, and we will definitely catch you then. Welcome everybody to this episode where myself and Andy are going to be covering various different things that have happened and changed in general practice, including the GP referendum result, stuff around the GP contract that has actually dropped. So we've got details on the final version of the GP contract, and it is a little different to what they told us about. Also, we're going to talk about satisfaction in the NHS, more stuff around PAs, and even some good news stories. So let's get cracking as we tech enhance your primary care and learning. Hello, HEP learners. Welcome to this bank holiday weekend. That's right. Myself and Andy, despite it being a bank holiday, are still here joining you all. And thank you all for joining us. We've got over 30 people joining us live at this time, which shows amazing dedication from you all. But we've got so much content to get through in this episode and a couple of sneak announcements as well that you'll definitely want to stick around for, particularly if you want to know about the GP contract and stuff. But how are we doing there, first of all, Andy?
Yeah, pretty good. Another busy week, but enjoying the bank holiday weekend. I can see the sun outside. It's beckoning me out. So I'll be out in the sunshine later, I think, if it holds.
Definitely. So what are we talking about this week then, Andy?
Yeah, so let's have a quick rundown so people know what to expect. So the BMA referendum on the GP contract, the results have dropped. We'll be talking about that. There are some new contract documents that have dropped from NHS England around the DES and the GP contract. So we'll be having a look at what's inside them, but probably having a look in more detail in some breakout episodes. Public satisfaction in the NHS is at an all-time low, so we'll be digging deep into that story, having a little look into how effective primary care is and some of the funding issues around the NHS. We'll then be talking about PA regulation, so a bit of a somewhat can be a controversial topic, and we'll be having a look at that. The GMC have released some opening a consultation into the regulation of PAs. We'll be having a look into that story. I'm just going through the tabs. Good news story. I'll be ending with a good news story. We should keep you waiting to know what that is. But in fact, yes, we'll keep you waiting to see what that good news story is, but something that we think is a positive development. So let's get cracking, Gandhi, perhaps with that first story about the GPC vote.
Yeah, so this is covering the big news that dropped a couple of days ago. So we've been talking about the BMA GP referendum that's been going on for the past few weeks. It started on the 7th of March and concluded on the 27th of March, and the result came out literally straight away afterwards. So kudos to the BMA and the GPC for doing this, but effectively it showed over 99% of GPs voted no to accepting the current contract, which we are going to talk about in a short period of time. But that is a donking result, isn't it, Andy?
It is. So 99.2% have voted no to the question about do you accept. It was a single one question referendum. Do you accept the new GP contract was the question asked. Balloted about 19,000 GPs. I don't know if you know GPs and GP registrars, so GPs and GPs in training. Do you know how many GPs there are in the country? I think it used to be about 38,000-40,000 used to be the figure I...
Yes, so no definitive register because unfortunately the registers aren't generally accurate. I know there's supposedly something like 75 across the whole of the UK. England, there is estimated around 40,000, I think it is, active. If you go by the RCGP membership, which is about 52,000, but don't forget that also includes those GPs who are no longer actively working, as well as various other affiliate memberships as well that they sort of have. So that's the membership, including international. So I'd probably say between 40,000 and 50,000 is right for England Again, I don't know the definitive figures, and if somebody does know those definitive figures, please let us know, because that would always be useful information to know. But it's a significant amount that over almost 50% of people engaged with the thing. But out of that, so the number of respondents was over 60% of the BMA GP membership. So out of the people who could respond, over 60% did respond. Out of that, over 99% said, no, we don't want this contract.
Yeah, I think it's fair to infer that GPs do not accept the new contracts from those figures, any way you cut that or look at it, which is really, really resounding. Gandhi, I'm going to ask you two questions for the benefit of the audience out there. And very briefly, most of them will know this, but some might not. So why is there dissatisfaction with the new GP contract?
So we're going to talk about some of this in a second when we come to the contract itself. But the key thing is the big headline stuff. The five-year contract that was negotiated as part of the PCN DES contract back in 2019 carried on subsequent years. And there was set amounts of increases that came with that, which was about 2% each successive year. Obviously, inflation has been ball busting compared to that. And then this was the year that they could have renegotiated a different amount. The Department of Health were quite clear to NHS England, we are giving you a maximum of a 2% increase in the value of the GP contract. That's what's been offered. That's what is confirmed in the letter we're going to talk about a little bit later on. And as a result of that, the GPC are quite rightly saying this is not enough to make general practice function. And actually, when we look at some of the other data that is around since then, it shows that actually general practice, which is the only part of the NHS that doesn't run at a deficit and has also the only part of the NHS that has significantly increased its work output in terms of appointments and contacts, actually gets the least increase across the board from the NHS and stuff. So that I think that's why most people are dissatisfied with it. We're seeing the impact of that in terms of employment, seeing the impact of that in terms of service to patients and the capacity, and the fact that many practices are now handing back their contracts because they just cannot make it financially viable. There is some promise of adjustments coming through, and we'll talk about those again a bit later on. But it's basically everyone's really unhappy with the contract that's being offered. And quite rightly, I mean, myself and Andy have been quite vocal about this. We agree that the contract is not fit for purpose. But it seems like majority of you agree. What's interesting is that 0.8% said they were happy with it, which surprised me. So that works out about 152 respondents when you factor in the numbers. If any of those are watching, please let us know why. Really would like to know.
Yeah, really would be interesting to know why, why they feel voted in favour of it. I mean, it might be that people worry about what industrial action might look like and, what that might look like for their practice and their patients. People might have anxieties about that cause them to feel that they have to accept the new contract, potentially. Some people might have ticked the wrong box. That always happens with a very small minority of people completing online forms. It could be about 0.8%. I don't know. So, yeah, I think you're giving a good roundup there of why people aren't happy with the new contract. And for me, I think the big thing is the funding uplift to the value of the core contract at just 2%. I know that the BMA and the GPC did some calculations, and very simple calculations, to demonstrate that to get general practice back to where it should be if you'd applied normal inflationary increases, so in real terms, to get general practice back to where it should be in real terms relative to 2019 levels of funding, it was an 8.7% increase, and that's what they'd asked for, which is quite modest compared to what say junior doctors have been asking for and so forth, but they felt that 2% was a in real terms decrease in funding and represents a reduction in the ability to deliver on that contract, and is not acceptable for patients or GPs, and that's why it's been voted against, really. So the other question I had for you was what next, and I know we looked at a timeline, didn't we, in terms of what next, and maybe we can find that quickly, but what next? What does this mean, do you think? What is going to happen next in very simple terms?
So in simple terms, immediately, not a great deal, I don't think. Obviously, that figure will be used, I suspect, in discussions with the Department of Health and NHS England to understand what's happened. Obviously, we are now into an imposed contract for the third year in a row, and we will talk about the imposed contract. Like I said, the other big news story for today is the imposed contract has dropped. So myself and Andy will be talking about that in a second. but I suspect this will be used in conversations to show what's going to happen moving forward. A lot of this, I think, will be determined by other timelines. The big one being obviously the pending election will be the big thing that I think determines how much action the GPC will take. But I suspect this will be gearing up towards some form of industrial action if there is no significant changes offered in the next few weeks or so. I think a turning point will be the LMC conference, which is towards the end of May. And if any of you are heading towards that, this will be my first LMC conference I actually get to attend officially. So I will be there as well. I'm contemplating videoing it as well, Andy, which Andy does not know about because Andy unfortunately can't attend. But it'll be interesting to see what comes out of the LMC UK conference that comes from that point of view as well. So I think there are some stepping points. I think the question of what does industrial action look like for general practice, which is what I think some of this is gearing towards, is the big question. And this reminder, the referendum is not a question on GPs doing industrial action. It was just simply a question on, are you happy with the contract, which are two separate things. So it will be interesting to see what the profession goes to. But I think if you want to exemplify that with some other stats and facts and stuff, so you may have seen it flash up briefly on the screen, people. So I'm just going to share this with you. This is an amazing page if you want details. It's done by Dr. Steve. I'm going to try and zoom. Sorry, I've got it on my vertical screen, Andy. This is the thing. Let me see if I can zoom in. There we go. So that's a bit better, isn't
it?
Okay. So this is by Dr. Steve, and I've forgotten his surname. Apologies on that. But NHS Facts and Stats is a Facebook page. Highly recommend you follow it. And in this, Steve does some amazing graphical stuff, taking note from some of the stuff I did a while back ago, and he's just ran with it amazingly. But this is the headline finger. General practices get just 5.4% of the NHS budget this financial year. 5.4% for doing over 90% of the work put in general practice. That's it. Steve Taylor. Thank you, Dave, who's mentioned it in the comments, and a couple of others have. Dr. Steve Taylor, apologies. I blame my fasting and stuff, but that's monumental, the amount of funding that general practice, and that is a significant drop. I mean, I remember a few years back when we used to say general practice got 7%, got 9%, and that was not enough. It's actually even less now. So, that is just shocking to me.
Where's the extra money been going, Gandhi, in the NHS? Is that visible on? I can't quite see.
So if I make that bigger, so this is a box plot graph. So you've got NHS provider and staff costs, you've got procurements, you've got non-NHS contracts, primary care. I think there's some crossover with primary care and PCNs in this, but this is about funding direct to general practice in terms of the core GMS contract that he's talking about with the 5.4%. Obviously, that doesn't include the PCN DES contract, from my understanding, which is additional funding. But don't forget, it's not directly for general practice. It's for primary care, separate things. And then there's other stuff like clinical negligence, COVID inventory, local authority grants, non-NHS healthcare, private providers, prescribing, etc. and stuff. So there's loads of other stuff in there. But I think that's just a significant thing to take note of from my perspective. And it's intriguing, isn't it, Andy?
Yes, we've got, considering a lot of focus in the media has been on primary care access. Most of the stories I think about the NHS, or a lot of them, have been about primary care. So for that to happen and for funding to fall, I think is really, really interesting. I guess it also interesting is where you count the primary care networks in that, because that is often described as additional funding for general practice as well as for primary care. Yes. And I think part of the difficulty has been the mixed messaging around what that money is, specifically for. Is it to support core general practice delivery, or is it to do additional things? The additionality word is used a lot with primary care networks. So, and actually in reality, because you can't pay for doctors and nurses, or haven't previously been able to pay for nurses, it's not really, I'm not sure you can call that funding for core general practice, but some people might want to include it.
And I guess just a shout out, so regular EGP learner viewer Miss Melody, 99.2% is incredibly telling. That's a huge amount. Absolutely agree. And if any of our 60 plus live viewers want to comment and stuff, feel free to do so. We will bring them on throughout. I think now, though, we're going to move on to talk about the other big thing that dropped that hasn't really hit the news headlines at all yet, probably because it's a bank holiday weekend, and that's the new GP contract. So the official version has dropped. Myself and Andy are briefly going to cover that in this episode, But what I would highly recommend that you do is join us next week. So as an extra special live episode, myself and Andy are going to go live next Saturday at 11 a.m. and go through the final version of the GP contracts in absolute detail like we normally do. So do make sure you join us for that. And actually, Andy, could you put that on the screen if you can?
Yes, I can.
I appreciate I'm making you out of sync just because I want to show some people things and stuff. So we're just waiting for that to come up.
Do you want to know how to use System 1 more effectively as a clinician? There are various different things you can look at, but there is only one course that can help you understand this and have all my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, and that's the System 1 course for clinicians. If you want to have a look at it, have a look bit.ly/TPPS1course, TPP and S1 in capitals. But if you do have a look at it, what will you get? Well, you'll get content and information and guides on how to use System 1 more effectively, from getting started with System 1 to navigating the patient record, to understanding the key parts like doing a consultation, as well as prescribing, clinical admin, communication, and various other information. And this includes my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, so it saves you time and your patients stress in terms of their navigation with their patient journey. If you want to have a look at it, check out the link. As I said, it's bit.ly/TPPS1course, and the TPP and S1 are all in capitals, and you will get access to all this content perfectly. Even better yet, there's a money back guarantee. So if you don't actually find this course has helped save you some time, just let me know. I'll refund you the course once you've completed it and stuff. Catch you then.
Oh my goodness, that's meta. I started watching Us Live on YouTube accidentally, which is not what I was after. Okay, contract review. Is this what you're after, Gandhi?
That looks like the one, so let's add that to the stage. So what I would recommend that you do, if you haven't done so already, there should be a subscribe button somewhere, which we may not be able to see on ours, because there we are, that little black box near to the bottom. If you click on that, it'll say, if you're not subscribed, subscribe, and then click on the notify me bit. And what that'll do is YouTube will then send you a little thing that says when we go live that you're aware of it and stuff, so you can join us next week for our extra special episode talking about the final version of the GP contract in more detail, which we're going to have a look at right now, aren't we, Andy?
Yeah, let's jump into Acrobat Reader. I'll zoom in a little bit. So I think there's three things we're going to look at today. So there's the letter around PCN and core practice funding, mm-hmm. And then there's the headline letter about changes to the PCN network DES, and mm-hmm. then we'll just kind of trail what we'll be doing next week by having a look at least the contents page of part A of the network DES, because that's where they've rolled up all of those individual sort of 8 specifications that were that part of the PCN network DES into this new part A. They said they would replace it all with one specification, and they have. It's called part A. It does have a number of individual components within it, but that's what they've done. So shall we kick off with this letter, Gandhi? Is that where you're wanting to start?
Yeah, I think that's probably the best. That's the actual GP contract letter. So maybe we're zooming in if we can, Andy. There we go. So it talks about the financial entitlements and stuff. It talks about the fact that the allocations have been sent to the ICBs, and that, you know, there's more detail coming down. It talks about the difference in allocations between last financial year and this now financial year that starts in a week or so, including the DDRB uplift for 23-24, which is the 6% that we heard about a few months back. It talks about changing the direction of the SDF funding into the core PCN DES contract. So if you, many people remember, we talked about this in our previous episodes on the GP contract, didn't we, Andy?
Yeah, I was, again, we were having a discussion, weren't we, about whether this was new money or not. It's described in the next paragraph below as combining the leadership development money with the PCN, the 44 million, which must be this, I guess, leadership money, with the clinical director funding. So we weren't sure that actually was representing new money in this table. If people have a better understanding, please let us know.
I kind of wonder if that's the leadership funds that was given to ICBs that they're now giving direct to PCNs. Now, again, it's not really clear on this particular letter from our perspective. And again, if somebody's watching this that does know better than us, please let us know. But I wonder if that's the funds that was originally given to the ICB to disseminate, which some places got, some places didn't. But it suggests that this should be now going direct to the PCNs to use as their discretion, which would be interesting because that's potentially more control over available funding that's relevant, I think, and stuff. And then, then talks about the additional IIF funding. So this is specifically around the cancer part of the IIF. So remember that the IIF criteria drops from 5 criteria down to 2, of which the only 2 continuing for the IIF is going to be the early cancer screening, which is the FIT testing, as well as the learning disabilities check. So it looks like they're putting a little bit additional funding into the early cancer diagnosis one, which I don't remember them talking about giving extra funding for that in the previous letter. I think that is new.
I don't remember that either. And it's always difficult to know what's new and what's come from other places, you know, similar to this 44 million above. And of course the DDRB, you know, that's added from last year, right? So because that wasn't there at the beginning of last financial year, so I'm presuming that's also additional. Because if you work out the increase from 10,612 million to 11,222, it's about 5.7%, which is quite a lot. And I find it hard to believe that that's all new money. So I think a lot of this might previously have been announced or accounted for.
Yep. And then the other baseline growth, I believe that's the general increase that we've got on the contract, which is the 2% and stuff, which is not quite 2%, which I don't quite understand.
Yeah, that's not 2% of that figure. Yeah, although they talk about the ARS funding, I think that's broken out separately, Gandhi, in the table below where we're talking about the additional roles reimbursement.
Well, just before we get to that, Andy, so Christine has asked the question, our staff doesn't appear to have increased by 2%. Am I missing something? Actually, we think it is, and I can't remember if it's this one. It's this table, isn't it, Andy?
Yeah, it's this table, which I believe represents the ARS funding, showing the previous increase from 22-23 to 23-24, and then a further, much more modest increase, which I make to be 2.05% increase on the ARS budget. Again, might be wrong. We've not spent very long with these figures, and we'll be digging into them a bit more detail.
Yeah. I'm just going to take over the screen share for a second, Andy, just because people are asking. So I need to get rid of that. And just because I'm aware I've got it on screen share and you don't. So let's go to that, and entire screen, that one. So people are asking in the chat, where do we find these documents? So NHS England has a habit of dropping documents on their publications page. So you go to england.nhs.uk/publication. It does come in date order, so I can see Dave's asking where, really struggling to locate all these documents, and it comes in date order, so they do go very, very quickly. And then you've got all these, there's literally like 12 different containers for different parts of the guidance, which myself and Andy are going through, and we're already on the second page one, which are the summary letters, which is what we're talking about today. We will go through the more detailed ones next week and stuff, but going back to Andy, there we go. This is the main letter. There is the increases that they mention. I think the key thing that I've noticed is there's a little bit extra funding for the cancer screening, which is welcome. It does also talk about the capacity and access improvement plan, of which, you know, it reconfirms its commitment to paying the additional funds from that the IF funding from the other three criteria have been rolled into this. So then it does increase the value of the capacity index improvement plan funding. And then the fact that the 30% is available in the year if your PCN clinical directors confirm that you have achieved those based on the 3 criteria, which is better digital for telephony, simpler online consultations, and faster care navigation assessment responses and stuff. Yeah. So
interestingly, Gandhi, on first reading with previous documents, I thought the clinical directors were going to have to confirm that all of these were in place for each of their practices. But it says here at least one of the 3 components, put in place one or more of the 3 individual components at each practice in the primary care network. So that's much more achievable.
No, if you read the next line, though, Andy, it says each component attracts a third of the CAPE funding.
Okay.
So that is 10% overall. So you do, once you've done one, you get 10% out of that 30%. So if you've only done 2, then you get 20%.
Oh,
if you've done all 3.
Yeah.
So I think that's a more fortunate way of doing it, which means that practices and networks can access that funding quicker. Whether the interesting thing will be whether the ICBs agree to disseminate the funding in the same way that it's based on when you've achieved each 10%, whether they criteria it to say that you have to achieve all three before they'll pay for, because the funding will go to the ICBs, I believe. It's not NHS England that will be disseminating this. It's the ICBs, because they will be given the response to do that and stuff. So
yeah. I think they have to send it back, though. If they don't, they can't spend it on other things. So there's an incentive of them to try and get it out to practices where practices
have. You would hope so, yes. And then the last thing in the contract is the weight management enhanced service. Now, myself and Andy thought that we would cover this for you all separately as a separate episode, but when we've read through the container, the letter for this, to be honest, there's virtually no changes whatsoever compared to previous years, apart from they've just updated the dates and the years and stuff. So it is exactly the same as the previous weight management episodes. So if you want to check back, we can, if you just type weight management service EGP learning, I think we did an episode on this about a year or so ago, that'd be worth having a look at and things from there. So that's the main contract letter. I think in addition to this is the PCN DES letter, which is separate to this. So this goes in a little bit more detail to the PCN DES, and it's just zooming in so we can have a look at that.
I think this is all things that we are already aware of, that it's confirming here. I don't know if you spied anything new. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it accompanies the full DES guidance, which has been released on the website, that page that you showed before, you can get that from there. And yeah, we've had a quick look, but we'll take some more time to go through and go through these with you next Saturday. I think we already know that the updated specification introduces these principles, principal changes in the following areas. So shall we take it in turns? Giving PCNs more staffing flexibility by including enhanced nurses in additional roles reimbursement scheme. Giving PCNs and GPs more flexibility by removing all caps on all direct patient roles and clarifying requirements for physicians' associates to reflect the latest guidance. So more flexibility, and you can have those additional physical extend. What's the language they use around nurses?
Enhanced nurse practitioners.
You can have enhanced nurse practitioners in additional roles. The next one, Gandhi, was...
Supporting practices and PCNs to improve outcomes in terms of the simplified requirements, which we'll be talking about next week. So this is where they've simplified the 8 PCN DES requirements into one big overarching one. There are some interesting changes in that, but like I said, we will cover that in more detail next week. So make sure you join us for that. And just to exemplify that even more clearly, Miss Melody again, my Alexa has an alarm set 2 minutes before the live starts. So even if I forget, Alexa will make sure I'm present. We live in crazy times. You can miss the update. So do that. Join us, like the 90 plus of you that are joining us live now.
Which is great.
Yeah, amazing. Really is. Then we've got number C. Andy, do you want to go through that?
Yeah, one? Helping practice and PCNs provide improved patient experience by increasing the capacity and access payment. Okay, so they rolled some of the other IAF into that, which now starts to be paid at any point in the year. Once PCNs confirm they meet the simple criteria for payment, I think it was paid out much less frequently before. Can be paid up to 3 tranches to reflect the 3 domains. So that's good.
Then simplifying the PCN clinical director role. So my job description has now apparently changed without me having been consulted on it. However, key responsibilities are now coordination of the service delivery, allocation of resources, supporting transformation towards modern general practice. That's the key thing that is specified as part of the PCN clinical director job role now, which wasn't previously in there, and supporting the PCN role in developing integrated neighborhood teams, which that one was partly in there and stuff. So, important to be aware of that from there. I know we've had a request to share the documents thing in the chat, so I'm just going to do that while Andy reads the last one.
Yeah, go on, you can pace, and I'll talk about rolling the PCN Clinical Director and PCN Leadership and Management funding, which will be 89 million combined, into core PCN funding, giving 183 million in total. This is intended to provide PCNs with greater autonomy and to allow PCN Clinical Directors to lead their PCN in the way that best suits local arrangements. So looking at the funding, we thought that this probably means that perhaps some funding which was delivered to ICB support leadership and management development in primary care networks may go straight to primary care networks now, although obviously local arrangements often can be different, etc. disclaimers, but we are not your ICB. We do not know exactly how this will be implemented, but that was our interpretation. So,
yep.
So interesting. And then the participation, if you're signed up, you don't need to re-sign up for it. It's assumed that PCNs will roll over in their current form. But if a practice wishes to opt out or make changes, do so before the 30th of April.
And that's an interesting point. So obviously we know that many more people are dissatisfied with the contractual side of things. And we talked about what step would the GPC make. Potentially, there is a month period where practices can opt out of the PCN DES contract for this financial year, because doing it after so is more difficult. The updated terms of the contract do make reference to what happens in more clarity as to what happens if a practice is not part of a network and the implications of that, and a bit more focus on the ICBs being more responsible when this happens. I think this might actually happen more this year than any other year, to be honest. So it'll be interesting to see what does happen. But if you don't want to be part of the PCN DES, you've got a month to decide that as of today.
Interesting. If anybody's thinking about opting out, say so in the chat.
Yeah, let us know down below what you're thinking. Are you going to opt out of the contract, the PCN DES contract, or not? And with, you know, if you wanted to know about a vote, I've already done a separate vote on our YouTube channel whilst we've been going live so far. That was, do you agree with the GP 2024 GP contract? 94% from our vote has said no, Andy. I'm going to put a new one in now. So if you are watching us live on the YouTube channel, tell us if you're going to opt out of the PCN DES contract.
Interesting. I've just put on screen just to sort of trail what we'll be doing next week. But one of the big things that I was looking out for was what was happening to those 8 service specifications within the PCN DES contract, because they said they would simplify them into one. So those have become part A, clinical support services. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a separate PDF now that you can look at separately. And I'm just bringing the introduction onto the page, really. We had a comment from Elizabeth Dobson saying, well, they've taken population health management out of the CD role, and that does appear to be the case. Population health management is now a line within the DES specification. Mm-hmm. So they've replaced all of those 8 areas with these 3 areas that focus on improving health outcomes and reducing health inequalities, including population health management, health inequalities, CVD prevention and diagnosis, and early cancer diagnosis. So there's some alignment with things like the 6 major disease strategy, which we've covered on the podcast as well. That's a very interesting document. So there's some alignment with that. Also looking at targeting resources and efforts, so proactive care for frailty. Mm-hmm. Structured medication reviews still have prominence, so does social prescribing, and enhanced health in care homes remains as part of the specification. And then they talk about enhanced access. And we'll talk a minute about the dissatisfaction with the NHS, but this is a big driver of those figures, access to general practice. So that's a big area. Delivery enhanced access, delivery models for enhanced access and appointments. Error bookmark not defined. I don't know quite how that's made. I didn't put that there. That's probably come through NHS England. And funding for enhanced access in the network contract, DES. So those are the main contents of part A. So that'd be really interesting to go through next
Definitely.
Week.
Definitely. And again, if you want to join us for that episode next week, do make sure you sign up so you get notified of it. Because in addition to that, we will probably also cover the QOF changes as well. Because it's not as big as I think we can fit it in, but it depends on how many of you join, and we will see what we can do and stuff. But let's talk about other stuff. So we've talked about loads of stuff.
Are there some comments to take, Andy? Or
okay, yeah, let's go to the comments.
We've been keeping on top of those.
We've covered most of them, I think. Like I said, so Adil Azim asked if we could share the link for the document. So I shared the PCN DES link and stuff. If you want to go to the more bigger container one, I will put that in now. So the main NHS England links, but all of these will be in the show notes for this episode when we finished. Me and Andy do that every episode at the end and stuff, but I have just put that in the chat for all the different places wherever you may be watching us. And then just simply we've had wow, it's Melody about the details and stuff and things. So it's interesting what's going on currently. But let's talk about satisfaction in the NHS, or should we say dissatisfaction in the NHS. So this was the big news story of the week. It hit the national headlines as well, as you would expect when anything about the NHS seems to come through. So public satisfaction with the NHS is at its lowest level ever recorded. I think, was it 24%?
Yeah, 24% of people satisfied with the NHS. So, yeah, so this drew a lot of national attention, but sort of as ever, we want to get a little bit sort of behind the national coverage, just sort of think, where are they getting their information from? You know, what's prompted this? So the King's Fund have published findings from the British Social Attitude Survey. So that's where this comes from. And this is where they ask all sorts of questions, including around satisfaction of the NHS. So this is where the data's come from. And actually on the King's Fund website, we'll put the link below. There is some really good summary with some graphs. So looking at the main data, and actually a lot of the mainstream media's coverage seems to follow a similar structure to this press release. So we're starting to kind of learn how these things work and how the journalists often, where they get their stories from. It's good to go to the source. So this survey's been running since 2020. So it's to say ever, but not 2020. When did it? 1983. Mm-hmm. Sorry. The survey's been running since 1983.
Yeah.
And runs annually. And this is the first year that it's dropped below a quarter. 24% of people are satisfied with the NHS. Only 13% of people are satisfied with social care. Shall we go through and have a look at some of the figures? So this is a graph showing satisfaction in the NHS from 1983. I'm going to zoom in.
Zoomy zoom.
So really interesting, because you've got very or quite satisfied is purple, and the red one perhaps is the one to look, very or quite dissatisfied. And actually, running up to the pandemic, they were actually at fairly low levels of dissatisfaction. And then throughout the pandemic and post-pandemic, it's really shot up to 52% of people being very or quite dissatisfied, and satisfaction shot down from pre-pandemic about 60% satisfaction with the NHS to this 24 figure. So that's all really changed just in the last few years. Really interesting. You know, any thoughts why that is, Gandhi? Is it all just because things got overwhelmed and haven't recovered properly, or is there something else driving that? What do you think, Gandhi?
I think the backlog probably has a huge proponent to contribute to this. So we know the fact that hospitals are struggling to get back through the sheer backlog, and that's having a knock-on effect with every other aspect of general practice and healthcare in itself. People are struggling as a result of that. If you go back up to the graph though, Andy, the other thing I take reference to, and I know people are probably going to say, well, Gandhi, of course you're going to mention this. If you go back to 1997, which was the last time that the Tories were in power, that was the only real significant other time that dissatisfaction was higher than satisfaction. And then Labour took over, invested more resources into the NHS, and then that gradually started. And look at the gulf widening that we saw from there, from satisfaction to dissatisfaction. And then the knock-on effect of a subsequent Tory government, which kicked in around about 2010, wasn't it?
About 2010, but it's reached a high point of satisfaction.
Yeah.
Held steady until the pandemic, though.
It did. And then the pandemic, I think, like I said, a lot of it is down to the backlog. I genuinely feel a huge amount of this dissatisfaction that's going on is driven by the significant problems of the backlog that we've had. And obviously, they would have kicked in from 2019 onwards. I think the subsequent stuff is about the fact that the NHS is... The government continue to say that they are investing record amounts in the NHS. Well, just simply from inflation alone, it will always be, each year will be record amounts just to keep pace with inflation in a monetary value. But in terms of
disingenuous, isn't it?
It is massively so. So it's a headline that I know that the media and the government use on a regular basis, that record amounts are invested in the NHS. It's always going to be record amounts because they have to for inflation. Unless we go through a deflation period that, you know, means that the British pound drops in significant value, which it hasn't done yet in comparison. That will always be the case. It's the percentage share that's the key thing that is more important to look at and stuff. And actually, we know that resources are not kept in place. And we will talk about this in the fifth part of this episode, I think.
We'll talk about it a little bit more. I've got I want to say about population growth in the UK as well. Which,
well, that as well.
Even on GDP figures. So let's have a look at some of these other things. Because there's some interesting take-homes, really. So summary of satisfaction with NHS and social care services in 2023. So this breaks it out into individual kind of main service areas in the NHS. So let's look at where general practice is here. And again, let's look at satisfaction, very or quite satisfied, because that's how the media has been reporting this. So we've got 34% satisfaction with general practice, a little bit ahead of accidents in the emergency department, 31%. Mm-hmm. Dentistry not doing very well at all in terms mm-hmm. of satisfaction with NHS coverage. NHS overall at about the levels of the dentistry. So maybe going to the lowest common denominator there without patients having higher levels of patient satisfaction, social care mm-hmm. there at 13. So that's interesting to see how that overall average figure breaks out into the individual service areas. And then the reasons why people are dissatisfied. So this is reported in the mainstream media stories. And the main reason is it takes too long to get a GP or hospital appointment, with 71% saying they're very or quite dissatisfied with that. Mm-hmm. And 6% feel that they've been driven, that satisfaction has been driven by stories in the newspaper, on the radio, TV or social media. So that's quite,
I think it's much higher than that personally, but yeah.
So interesting. Money is wasted in the NHS. 32% people believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's always money wasted in any big organization, I suppose. You know, ever will it be true, but it's whether that's avoidable wastage, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah.
And then I thought this was interesting as well, because they test the public support for the core principles of the NHS. There isn't a graph here showing this changing over time, but apparently these are holding up well. So in terms of people's, how much people agree with things like, should the NHS be free of charge when you need to use it, or that's a good driving principle. 77% of people agree with that. Should it be available? The NHS should be available to everybody, 67%. And the NHS should primarily be funded through taxes. So 49% are say that definitely applies. 34% say probably applies. So there's about 17% of people disagreeing, by my interpretation, that the NHS should be funded through taxes. So there's core principles holding up quite well. And then the final one is the question asked was, suppose the government had to choose between the following three options, which would you choose? So I guess this must add up to 100. Increase taxes and spend more on the NHS, 48% of people approve on that. Keep taxes spending on the NHS at about the same level as now, 42%. So there's only 6% of people advocating a reduction in taxes to spend on the NHS. 3% don't know. So that's sort of breaking down some of the figures behind the headlines that people are there.
Definitely. I don't know. It'd be interesting to know what people think about this and stuff in terms of the impact it's having and things. Let's see what we've got come through from the comments. So Chris Chant, they never account for inflation, which is ridiculous, invalid and disingenuous. So let's go back to our earlier comments and stuff that we made and things. What else have we got? it's jumping around. Miss Melody, how well do you think the NHS would cope if COVID reappeared right now? I think it would be absolutely decimated, to be honest, even more so than it currently is. What else have we got? Another thing to consider, general practice, since the last few years, patients are still in a mindset they always have to see a GP. I think that's a really valid comment coming from Ellie Weber-Priddy from Facebook and stuff, where they're watching us and things. So, you know, very much the terminology is always used, go see your GP. I think that terminology absolutely does need to change. It needs to be go see your practice team.
They talk about GP appointments, don't they? You know, in the press, and I think politicians speak in those terms as well. When actually the policy direction is leading to a system where people may not see the GP as much, and as you say, they may see a different professional. They may resolve their issue, you know, via an electronic consultation and not see anyone at all. You know, now or in the near future. So yeah, the language needs to shift.
Yes, of which NHS England don't count that data effectively, given the GPAD system, which, again, I have been a massive component of version against and stuff and things. But hey-ho, it is the system we are stuck with and things. Christina coming in with, NHS have funds to issue 451 pages of guidance for the new contract. Thought they were cutting bureaucracy. 451 pages to confirm funding reduction in primary care. Okay, contracts are always lengthy. I'm not going to deny that, unfortunately, that's one of the issues with bureaucracy, but I agree that a little less bureaucracy will always go a long way, and I think in my view in the general practice and stuff and things. But hey ho, Right, just before we crack on, Andy, I'm just going to mention this because I think this is absolutely awesome from my point of view. So we have over 100 live viewers for a bank holiday weekend.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for giving up your bank holiday Saturday. I can see the sunshine out my window.
I know. So just wanted to say thank you to the EGP learners for that, because that is amazing from my point of view, that we've got so many people joining us live on a bank holiday weekend. So thank you.
Anyway.
So let's get cracking with our next news story. So we talked earlier about some of the funding issues and stuff. So there's actually been a couple of papers that come out that talked about funding in general practice. And one of them we're looking at now, which is the funding of general practice, the actual evidence behind it. Andy's going to go through this in a bit more detail because he's read it in more detail than I have, to be honest.
Well, I'm going to just give the headline, actually, because it is quite a detail, quite academic paper, actually. But the conclusions are interesting, I think. So so this paper seeks to compare UK general practice against the four Starfield principles. So these are, and we'll have a look at those in a second, but those are widely accepted to be measures of good primary care. They've been around since, I think, the early 2000s, and they're sort of used internationally to design and evaluate primary care and general practice services across the world. And it compares UK general practice against those principles. If people are wondering what those principles are, so this is I did a quick search just to find a good explanation somewhere. This will be too small for you, but this paper is about primary care networks in Singapore, which is interesting. Singapore has quite a vibrant general practice and primary care sector in their health economy and health service, and they apparently have primary care networks. So this paper was rating their primary care network system against the four Starfield principles. But they talk about being comprehensive, and by that they mean, is it available to everybody? You know, and actually in the UK, everybody is registered with a GP, and we should have universal access. So that's really good. Is it the first point of contact of care for the system? So that's talking about, you know, are they acting as the gatekeepers effectively for the rest of the system? You know, can people get that first contact with them? Can they have access? Well, that's more a part of comprehensive care. These are all the C's, so they all have C in them. Comprehensive contact, the coordination of care. Practice is well placed to coordinate the different parts of the health service, which are increasingly specialized. So, and people say actually that the GPs are probably becoming the only remaining generalists in the system. I'm sure many people will disagree with that, but there is truth that we're becoming some of the only generalists.
Sorry, Andy, who's going to disagree with that?
Maybe the geriatricians or the community peds, you know. Maybe,
but again, they only cater for specific population. They don't cover for everything.
You know what? You're absolutely right. They can't disagree with that. They only look after old people or very young people. You're right.
Exactly.
The coordinators of care, how well placed. And actually, UK general practice is well placed to be coordinated and continuity of care. Can people see the same person or be managed by the same team through time? And structurally, UK general practice is well placed to deliver that. People are registered with individual practices. They should have a relationship with that practice and individual name GP. So structurally, this is all good. So the summary of this paper was that actually structurally, UK general practice is positioned to deliver the four Starfield principles really effectively in terms of how the system's designed. However, in practice, they felt that UK general practice was somewhat in crisis and actually underfunded, and that actually policymakers should have a focus on these. Were some of the guidance at the end of the paper. Policymakers should have a focus on giving the system enough resources and supporting GPs to improve and reinstate the quality of that service, which is all really, 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 really sensible to me. Any thoughts on that, Gandhi?
No, I mean, it's just more evidence about the fact that general practice needs more appropriate funding. And actually, if you were to fund it, it suggests that the healthcare system would be considerably better. And we just need the powers that be to understand that, to be honest.
I was having a bit of a diet. I tried this. This got me thinking actually about funding in the UK in the health service. It's worth talking about actually, because you've got absolute figures, haven't you, funding? You know, say, we're spending more and more each year in pound terms, and then you've got actually, what happens when you adjust that for inflation? And actually, there's less being spent on general practice now in real terms than there was in 2019, as evidenced by the BMA's GPCs saying actually we need an 8.7% increase just to get back to where we were in terms of the actual purchasing value of the pounds spent on general practice. And then people also talk about healthcare spend per GDP when we want to compare with other countries, you know, and that's what I just had a little dig into here. So GDP is gross domestic product. So that's the total value of the economic activity that happens within a whole economy. And then people often say, how much of that total value is spent on things like defense or healthcare? And, you know, so NATO has a 2% defense spending target, you know, for example. This is a way of comparing that spending across country. How much do they spend on certain aspects relative to the total value of their economy, or how rich they are, I guess, in general terms. And this is the United Kingdom's GDP spend on health over the past 40 years or so, going from about 5% in the early 1980s up at the peak of the pandemic to 12.2%, and then now dropping back down to 11.3%, which is interesting. And you sort of think, actually, what do other countries spend in terms of proportion of their GDP? You have to remember that some countries are richer than others as well, right? So the United States spends 16.6% on health compared to our 11.3%. But the actual United States economy per person is so much, they're actually a lot richer than us anyway. So actually, in dollar terms, that would be even higher. But anyway, I was just thinking, actually, what if we at 11.3% funded our health system to a similar level, say Germany, you know, perhaps a fairly comparable UK country. And actually that would take the NHS budget, which is about 182 billion to 204 billion. So actually, whilst, 1.4% increase might not sound a lot, that would be an enormous amount of money to distribute across the health service. Go a long way to improving things. Sorry, perhaps a little bit of a technical rant there, Gandhi. Do you have any thoughts on the level to which we fund our system or how we talk about it?
Well, it just marks the fact that I think, unfortunately, our recent government have not been as truthful as they claim to be in terms of the amount that they fund the healthcare service. Comparatively, whilst, you know, like I said, the total value may be higher in terms of what they've invested from previous subsequent years, the percentage amount of that doesn't follow through, and actually we are investing less in healthcare, and this is part of the reason why I think it's struggling. And if you go back to that earlier graph, you know, the one that you showed with the fact that the amount has actually dropped in the recent years, despite the COVID stuff. So, you know, that significant increase was funding that was made available for COVID. That funding has dropped. So even though they're talking about recovering the NHS to cope with the demands post-COVID after everything paused for a while, you know, actually it's even less funding is now being offered. So it is disingenuous in terms of saying that, you know, there is record funding going into the healthcare system, because there isn't. There is your evidence, you know. And that's why we're struggling.
Another point that might feel a little bit technical, but the population of the United Kingdom has gone up significantly in the last few years as well. I think, was it sort of 300 and something thousand new people last year? I think it might have been a lot more than that. And actually the productivity of individual workers is not going up. So actually, whilst the headline to the GDP, the value of our economy might have gone up by 0.3 or whatever it was last year, actually, if the population's gone up by more than that, then actually the distance that 11.3% of your GDP has to go, you know, the number of people that you have to spend a similar amount on increases. So the actual spending per person, you know, can't go up as much. Anyway, getting very technical. I like this sort of stuff. But let's move on. We'll be below 100 again soon.
We're climbing still. We're now 120. So more it's stats. More details and stuff. So next we're going to talk about something. We had planned to do this as a recorded episode, but on review of it, we're not going to do that. And we'll explain why in a second. But there's a consultation now currently out about physicians associate and anaesthetic associates by the GMC. So obviously in recent news stories, we've been covering about the fact that there's been changes in guidance, particularly from the BMA and the RCGP, in terms of how physicians associates in particular should be used in general practice, and obviously anaesthetic associates in hospital environments is more relevant to that group. But there is now a consultation being started by the GMC around regulation for anaesthetic and physician associates based off the recent stuff that's been happening. So this consultation is open. There are a few documents to read before you start filling it in. It does take a little bit of time, I must admit. I think it takes about 20 to 30 minutes to fill in completely. And that's after you've read the stonkingly huge documents. But there are some reasonable summaries there that myself and Andy have had a quick look at. Given the way that the consultation is, we've decided not to review this in more detail for all of you, because we think, to be honest, the information is there and it's for you to make your decisions as to how you want to engage with it. But we would recommend having a look at this and maybe giving your input into it, because I think it is relevant to general practice and obviously some of the other things. And also encourage your, you know, rest of your team to have a look at it, physicians associates included as well, I think, from my perspective. I don't know what you think, Andy.
Yeah, so it's a consultation. Once you get into actually reading the consultation document and completing the consultation survey, it's quite dry, actually. It is about regulation. It's perhaps interesting just to look at what's included in the consultation, and they specifically say what isn't included in the consultation as well, which I think is important. So this is the consultation document, which they say you should read before embarking on answering the questions, so you know what it's about. So what they're consulting on, so a few areas, so education and training for those anaesthetic associates and physicians associates as well. So it's what standards should they meet at qualification. So they specifically, they're not talking about the scope of practice that develops post qualification, and that's not within the scope of this exercise. They're not talking about that, but they're talking about educational outcomes and qualifications, and how they will regulate that, because they regulate mm-hmm. that within medical schools, for example, the medical school curriculum. So they're talking about establishing that and how they will regulate that. They're talking about how they will form and keep a register of these professionals, like they do of doctors, for example. How things will go and come off the register, you know, how people will be removed from the register, how they'll deal with concerns. So this is largely the bread and butter of what the GMC does for medics, you know, setting the standards and then dealing with cases where those standards haven't been met. They'll also talk about fees as well, because I guess mm-hmm. none of this will come free. And, doctors and nurses are used to paying their professional body a fee for the self-regulation that they provide and what is not in it. So actually saying the existence of anaesthetic associates and PAs has already been legislated for in Parliament. That is not what they are consulting on. The professional titles and what they mean is not what they're consulting on. And the scope of practice, again, they're not consulting on that beyond setting the educational standards and curriculums. So that's not in there. But we thought it was worth mentioning and inviting people to become involved in this exercise by the GMC, because there is a lot of talk about physicians associates, in the kind of professional kind of social media circles. So,
yes,
and really. So, yeah, do you have your say?
I think so, and I think so. So, go to some of the comments we've had. So, Dave saying, given the BMA arm voted no confidence in the GMC last year, I think this is making reference to should you engage with this. I think, yeah, still, because this is stuff that's going to determine the scope and the role of physicians associates and anaesthetic associates in general practice. Many of our viewers will know I'm generally quite supportive of this when it's done in an appropriate and sensible way. I think that's part of the challenge that we've seen in terms of the misuse of physicians associates. And I think this is still a way to have input into that, because at the end of the day, the GMC are still the regulator. Well, they're going to be the regulatory body for them. I guess some of the points you made, Andy, I would absolutely recommend that the fees should be exactly the same as, you know, doctors pay if they're part of the same register. So therefore, that should reduce the amount that doctors have to pay for the GMC registration.
Maybe, the GMC has reduced rates for students in certain classes of doctors, I think.
I believe that's based on your working criteria rather than necessarily your level.
I think and that reflects the differing income levels of, mm-hmm. of different ways that doctors work. So I think that they should be, you know, involved in I think there's something should apply. I'm not sure they should pay the same as, you know, maximum doctor fees, but I don't think that's what you're suggesting, Andy. So
I think that it should be equivocal, which therefore would allow a better sharing of the responsibility. I think if we end up having a disparate fee structure for physicians associates who are on the same registers as doctors, that I don't agree with.
I mean, it will be a separate register, won't it? They're not on, but proportional to expected income, I would say, is a reasonable principle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool.
But let us know if you disagree.
Definitely. And we've got some comments coming through that we will come back to in a second. So thank you all for sticking those in and do continue to do so. But just before we get to those comments, we're going to cover our good news-ish story, shall we say? So this is around the primary secondary care interface. So this is a new story that literally just came out, I think, this morning. So let's have a little look at it, shall we? So hospital trusts must instate a designated lead to improve interface with GPs. Now, why are we covering this? Well, if you go back a year ago to when we had the GP contract from last year, one of the things that was in there that was really, really small print and really small section compared to the modern general practice that was the big thing that determined the GP contract last year was around better interface for general practice and secondary care. They've realized that this hasn't really gone as well as they planned. And despite it being in the contract, they are now stating that there should be a designated lead to improve the interface with general practice in each ICB. Thoughts, Andy?
Yes, I was really pleased to see this. And we have been challenged to try and be a bit more positive. So we thought we'd slot this one in at the end. And, you know, I was in a meeting with Claire Fuller last week. She came to meet Nottinghamshire sort of ICB and see how things were going, and really interesting, actually. Asked challenging questions, you know, as she should. Part of what she was doing, I think, was trying to both discover good practice in certain areas, to spread that to other areas, and then tell areas about, you know, and signpost them to good practice in other areas. And actually, in Nottingham, we have a designated lead within the trust for improving interface with primary care, and then our in Nottingham City, our place clinical director represents general practice, and there's a meeting that happens every week, and they discuss how primary and secondary care are working together. And actually, it is actually leading to some improvements. There's been a review of discharge summaries and an attempt to improve the discharge summary paperwork that comes out to primary care. There's been discussions around what are some of the things that have come out of it, Gandhi? I'm just thinking. My mind's gone blank, but there's been lots and lots of good work.
So I guess locally we've had lots of stuff around, you know, one of the big bugbears is GPs having to do fit notes. You know, that's massively been changed in our local area. So actually it's exceptionally rare that I will now be asked to do a fit note from secondary care. And the only times I can remember it having been done has actually been when, in going through it, the patient's not actually mentioned that they needed one, or that they thought they didn't need one. And then it turned out they did. So it's not necessarily been the responsibility or the fault of the secondary care clinicians that it's not been done. So that's been a real positive thing. The discharge summaries have become clearer. I think there is more clarity in some of the letters we get through in terms of GP responsibilities and secondary care responsibility. I think it can still improve, but it is much better than it used to be. So there is definitely some positive change. And I think one of the things that I find really interesting with this is that people often forget the stuff that's happened, that's changed, that made it easier, and then focus on the next annoying thing.
You do always move on to the next thing. I was thinking we have GPs that are present in junior and middle grade doctors and even consultant inductions now, just to represent local general practice and how they can work better with them, which is really, really positive. There's some discussions around shared care protocols, how they work and the burden that they impose on general practice and how they're managed. So that was one of the more recent discussions. So there's all sorts of good stuff going on. And anyway, I started with Claire Fuller because she said, this sounds like good work in Nottingham. Let's spread this around. And then lo and behold, this announcement comes out. So I was just wondering if there was some sort of connection. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't, but that's quite positive.
Interesting. I'm going to pick this up though, Andy. So I'm really glad that you're in that meeting, because I was declined to be invited to that meeting.
Really, were you?
Yes, especially since it would happen on my network patch as well. So I'm quite annoyed at that.
That's interesting. Okay.
I was told that the room was at maximum capacity, despite the fact the original plan for that meeting was to host it not only in my network area, but actually in my own practice building. And then they recited it to somewhere else.
I thought she was coming to my practice building as well in Bulwell in the afternoon, but she got on a train and went back when she came at lunchtime.
Yeah. I mean, so, no, Claire, if Claire Fuller does happen to watch this, which I don't think she does, but if anybody did decide to pass our streams to Claire Fuller as head of NHS England, again, open invite to come and join us, as previous directors of primary care have done so. But also, was that because you didn't want us to attend, or I don't know?
I'm slightly suspicious now
because I specifically
one of the rooms was very, very small, and I wasn't in that room. And then there was an adequately sized room as well, but there weren't other primary. But that was oddly, that was a smaller list of people and was more kind of ICBE sort of orientated. The second meeting. But anyway,
sorry for the segue there, all of our EGP learners. It was a more Nottingham centric kind of discussion.
Almost like no one was watching for a second.
It's that whole PCN engagement not present in a meeting around primary care. There you go.
Right. Shall we take a few more comments? I've just seen one which I can definitely answer. What happened to Andy's glasses? I haven't seen them in a while. Are contacts comfortable enough to wear daily? So, yeah, I'm in weekend mode at the moment. So it's probably that move from the Thursday back to the weekend schedule, which has meant the glasses have stayed on top of the bedside cabinet on Saturday mornings. So, yeah. I'd recommend daily contact lenses. They're fine. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I'm going to go back to an earlier point now. So Chris Chant made this very true. I remember how much contact per patient funding is based on, but this is much less than actually occurs. We're not funded for the level of access to illness and complexity. So I guess if you go through the funding, so the current GMS value of the contract is £1.07 when it's not weighted for London or Carhill changes. And that's based off the current contract. If you include additional contractual stuff that general practice gets, I think it goes up to about £160 per registered patient. If you follow the PSRU data, I believe that says something that GP consultation is approximately £36 for 12 minutes, I think it was. Don't hold me to those figures because it's been a while since I've had a look at them. So on average, that would suggest that the current amount of funding that general practice receives is for 4 GP appointments per year and a little bit of change left over. I would ask patients, I would ask people out there, how many of you have more than 4 GP appointments a year? How many of you have more contact? And don't forget, that's GP. For nurses, interestingly, it's almost equivocal amount because nurses, although they cost less to the system, they have generally have longer appointments. So the value of those tends not to be as that dissimilar. So actually, 4 appointments per year is what is currently funded by the healthcare service in general practice. So are you more than 4? Are you less than 4? I know the fact in my practice population, I've got 70 patients that have more than 40 appointments a year.
That's a lot. And I'm sure the story will be reproduced up and down the country as well. I was just frantically just trying to find a graph on online of consultation rate over time, but failed. If anyone finds a good graph, then pop that in the chat, because I think I have seen data and graphs that show that the rate of consultation has increased greater than the rate of funding increase. So, yeah, good point. I think sort of making the point and asking the question, really.
Yeah, interesting. So Dave McConnell mentioned local trust MD thought GP still give out fit to return work note certificates. Just to be clear, we do not. General practice does not give fit to return work notes and haven't done so for over 10 years. If you want a really good video, Dave, that you can send on EGP Learning, I've got an actual educational video on Med3s for doctors based off the EWP and government guidance. It's only about 5 minutes and it makes it really clear what they should and should not do. Feel free to send that. I send that with all my letters back to people when they have asked us for the inappropriate Med3s. Zalan, the PAs I supervised have been lovely. It's about groups trying to exploit them as a way of lowering costs and promoting them as alternative to doctors, then they should be able to complement them. Absolutely agree with that point. Definitely. I think that's my perspective of the change that we've seen as a result of that and things. And that's what's had an impact in a lot of the angst that we're seeing currently in both general practice and the wider sphere. It's misusing roles inappropriately and things that's had the impact and stuff from there. So, Andy, as we start looking at wrapping up, our thoughts on the stuff that's happened this week.
So, I guess, like, what were our learning objectives and what did we do today? So, it's been a long session, hasn't it? So we covered the unanimous vote to reject the GP contract, which I think we all expected. And I think what happens next, is the big question. I was going to say at the time that there's going to be some public sort of patient and professional consultation sessions run by the BMA to think about what would be appropriate in terms of industrial action. So that sounds like a really, really sensible way to get patients on board, or at least consulted with what's happening next. The next story that we did was around the GP contract. Did you have any take home from that, Gandhi?
So the GP contract is similar to the episode we covered about a month or so ago. You're welcome to have a look at that. Alternatively, you can absolutely join us live next week, where myself and Andy will go through the GP contract, the PCN DES contract, and the QOF contracts in more detail to go through the exact changes. There are some subtle changes that have happened since the original letter. An important thing to recognise, this will be the imposed contract, the third year in a row that it's going to be imposed on general practice in terms of what is required from us. Still raise that question, what happens if you act on a contract that you haven't agreed to or your union hasn't agreed to, but hey, we'll be there.
You can't remember, we covered this last year as well. It's this, they use the statutory instrument to push it through. They can do it. They've got the power. They're the government. So we then talked about the story that made the mainstream media about the lowest patient satisfaction with the NHS since records began, which was 1980, for this particular survey, 24% approval, or 24% people are satisfied with the NHS. And we dug a little bit into the study that was behind that, the British Social Attitudes study that's been published every year since 1980, and had a look at some of the themes in those questions around the NHS, with actually people, whilst being dissatisfied, still very supportive of those basic principles of the NHS, free at point of delivery, universally available to everybody, and paid for out of general taxation. So that was an interesting story. After that, we talked about NHS funding, didn't we, Gandhi? Did you have anything to round up about general funding of NHS and primary care and effectiveness of primary care? We looked at a paper that looked at the effectiveness of primary care.
And effectively, that showed that actually, if you invest in general practice and primary care more effectively, then that has better health outcomes for the population. And also, comparatively, we looked at the levels across both ourselves and other countries, and showed that actually England is lower than majority of the other countries, particularly ones of equivocal westernized population data kind of thing.
Western European countries.
Yeah, but also the amount of GDP investment is actually less this year compared to previous years, which absolutely has a factor in that. And then finally, we talked about the Physicians Associate and Anaesthetic Associates consultations by the GMC, which we'll put links to that down below if you want to have your involvement in that consultation. We'll take about 20, 30 minutes or so to go through once you've read the documents and stuff, but it may be useful for you to have your say, and both as a clinician but also a wider team would recommend doing that. And then we finished off, Andy, with
looked at the guidance that hospital trusts must instate a designated lead for improving interface with GPs, and we talked about the coincidence of timing of that coming a week after Claire Fuller visited Nottingham City and talked about the work being done on just that issue in Nottingham City. I felt that was quite positive, actually, and that positive things can come out of that work and that increased coordination between primary and secondary care, issues like signing of sick notes, how shared care protocols run, things like that. Lots of scope for improvement.
Mm-hmm. And just to point out that we've still got well over 100 people live with us today. So what have we got to wrap up with? Well, a couple of things I am going to mention very briefly for you all. So number one, myself and Andy only have about 2.5 weeks left till our PCN Plus live conference. It is fully booked out in person. However, you can absolutely join us remotely if you want to do so. And that's with ourselves, Ben Gowland from the GP General Practice podcast, and also Tara Humphreys from the Business of Healthcare podcast that Andy's trying to put the thing up. Sorry, I thought he had it up and it's
you're
gone.
You're still behind the curtain.
Yeah. So, okay, well, let's have a look at that. So if you do want to join us remotely, absolutely feel free to do so. It's an amazing conference. We've got some awesome content coming for you, and you will absolutely get to hear both mine, Andy's, and Tara and Ben's perspective on all the stuff that's coming through, as well as how to make your network and local area function so much more effectively. Got a little photos there as well. In addition to that, if you want to check out some stuff Tara's been doing, which I would really recommend doing so, there's a link to the Primary Network Members Club that she's got, which summarizes a lot of the GP contract changes in a reading format. So obviously myself and Andy do audio visual. Tara's much better at the blog formats and stuff. And if you want to have a look at that, feel free to do so. Next, after that, so in 4 weeks' time, myself and Andy have got our GP5T7 conference that we're doing here in Nottingham. There are about 10 spots left if you want to join us in person. So, you know, feel free to do so. It's an awesome, awesome conference. However, remotely as well, if you want to join us, do feel free to do so. It's going to be interesting. We've got some awesome content. I'm also going to be doing something that I don't think I've seen anywhere else, and that's covering AI in GP training. So this is the only place you're going to see it. And we've got some awesome things from Medics Money. We've got some sessions on humanities. We've got our Ask Us Anything panel as well. And if you are joining us in person, you'll get lunch provided, as well as some cool things that we've got planned. I may even get some extra surprises in there for people. And then more recently, I've started filming the Epic series for EGP Learning. So this is our EGP Learning podcast. Implementation consultation, hence why it's called Epic. Already got two episodes done, so they'll be coming out after Ramadan's finished and things. And it's basically how change happens in general practice, learning from our peers, learning from your fellow EGP learners. And you can join me on this if you want to, so you just need to apply down below and stuff, so feel free to do so. Any thoughts on the other stuff going on, Andy?
Gosh, I think you've covered it all, and I'm sure people are absolutely tired out now with all of the stuff that that has been going on and the stuff that's available. I suppose just join us next week for that, for the review of the new contract documents as well. We'll spend some time over the next week.
So if you want to do that, make sure you subscribe to the EGP Learning Podblast, regardless of which platform you're listening to us on, whether that's Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or another platform. And make sure you leave us a review, because it really helps us understand how we can better improve the content for you, especially as we soon launch our Epic episodes. So that's the EGP Learning Podblast implementation consultations, which we'll be starting shortly, so make sure you are subscribed to hear those, because only the podcast listeners will get access to those, unless you're in a really special group. And we will continue to tech enhance your primary care and learning. Catch you in the next episode.
Oh, hello there, EGP learner. I'm Dr. Gandalf, and I often get asked, what kind of resources do you have to try and help those using EMIS? Because you tend to do a lot more stuff for System 1. And often I've really struggled to answer that question, because let's be honest, I don't use EMIS on a regular basis. So therefore, trying to help EMIS users is a little bit more difficult for myself. And that really made me feel, well, not great. So I kind of did something to try and help all those EMIS users out there. I went and had a chat with one of my colleagues, Dr. Mike from GP on the Move, and him and I have created a course that you can use to help you use EMIS so much better. That's right, if you use EMIS but you want to use it so much better, so much quicker, and in such a way that means you go home sooner, then check out our EMIS for Clinicians course. It's an online course that takes you through all the tips and tricks that Dr. Mike knows to try and basically mean you can go home quicker. That'd be a cool thing, wouldn't it? And guess what? It's currently on offer. So if you want to take advantage of this introductory offer and get access to it now, look at the links down below and check it out. Additionally, if you're a practice, network, or wide area that wants more opportunity to use it, send me an email, egplearning@gmail.com. Let's see if we can help you out. And as I like to say, tech enhance your primary care and learning. Shall we get back to it? Oh, and if you wanted one for System 1 users, well, you know I've got you covered, haven't I? Check out the Learn System 1 for Clinicians course, bit.ly/TPP S1 course.